Tom Woods Show, episode 1419.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
All right, all you men out there, there comes a time in your life when you have to ask yourself, are you really a Tom Woods Show listener if you're not shaving with the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, namely Harry's Razors? Redeem your $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave over at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, just me today, talking about some material I've been reading in the American Conservative magazine. There's very often good material over at theamericanconservative.com, a lot of great foreign policy stuff there in particular. And I wanted to say a little something about a couple of pieces I'll be linking to at tomwoods.com/1419 that I think folks should know about. The first one is called Mike Pompeo, American Jacobin. And the second one is How the War Party Broke Trump. So let me start with a piece on Pompeo, because there's a lot for us to learn and understand in this piece. Pompeo, of course, is Secretary of State. He gave a speech at the Claremont Institute not long ago. The Claremont Institute is the hub of what we might call the West Coast Straussians. And I'll say a little bit, just about as much as you need to know about the Straussians, a little bit later on. But the dilemma that was facing, that's been facing people like Pompeo, is that they've got this Donald Trump who speaks the language, at least, of America First, who has spoken of the folly of some of the Middle Eastern interventions, who has indicated his desire to withdraw from at least some of it, and who thinks in general that it has spent a lot of money, that is, the war on terror has involved spending a lot of money, with not that much to show for it. So he's looked at it through the lens of a businessman. What am I getting for my money? So on the one hand, they have that. They have that, what to their mind is the toxic rhetoric of America First. And I always laugh at that America First would be a toxic phrase to use. Would you rather that he say America 27th? What exactly is wrong with that? But anyway, so what Pompeo does, and the reason they titled the article, it's an article by a fellow named William S. Smith. The reason they call it American Jacobin is they're talking about the French Revolution. They're saying that the French revolutionaries who initially wanted to, well, not just initially, but they wanted to spread the ideals of the French Revolution all throughout Europe. They wanted to have wars, of liberation throughout Europe, spreading the ideas of the French Revolution. But at the same time, they're faced with the fact that politically they cannot overcome the power of more traditional political thinkers who think that foreign policy is supposed to serve the national interest first and foremost. It's not supposed to be about ideological crusading. And the way out of that was simply to phrase and word and craft the foreign policy ideas of universalism, of spreading the universal ideas that the French had about people's rights. You just simply formulate that in such a way that it itself becomes a reflection of French nationalism. So you co-opt, in other words, you co-opt the language of your enemies and you make it serve the interests of your own ideas. And the author of this piece, fairly convincingly, I might add, makes the case that that's exactly what Pompeo is doing. He's in an administration that is using America First language and language about, at least language about the Constitution and traditional American foreign policy that views the current foreign policy as some kind of a deviation from the norm, but takes that language of nationalism and transforms it in a way that it can serve the foreign policy goals of the neoconservatives. Now, how does he do that? He does that by saying that really it's traditional American foreign policy to want to have a lot of alliances around the world. It's traditional American policy to be preemptive. It's traditional, it's traditional American policy to demand the respect of other countries or else. And so in that way, Pompeo can appear to be in the spirit of a kind of a belligerent form of America First, because we're simply reasserting traditional American principles and the traditional American foreign policy. So he can sound like he's going back in time to get his inspiration from a purer past. But it's a past that's being distorted by an ideological lens. So, for instance, Pompeo has to claim that John Quincy Adams was advocating and urging that Americans be respected in international affairs. That's what he was talking about, the need for respect in international affairs. But what he was really saying is that the United States should respect others. So, in fact, here's the passage everybody refers to from 1821, before John Quincy Adams became president, while he was still Secretary of State. Here's Adams. And you may have heard bits and pieces of this. I'm putting ellipses where, you know, we can easily skip some stuff. But he says, "And now, friends and countrymen, if the wise and learned philosophers of the elder world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, should find their hearts disposed to inquire what has America done for the benefit of mankind, let our answer be this. America, with the same voice which spoke herself into existence as a nation, proclaim to mankind the inextinguishable rights of human nature and the only lawful foundations of government. America, in the assembly of nations, since her admission among them, has invariably, though often fruitlessly, held forth to them the hand of honest friendship, of equal freedom, of generous reciprocity. She has uniformly spoken among them, though often to heedless and often to disdainful ears, the language of equal liberty, of equal justice, and of equal rights. She has, in the lapse of nearly half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when conflict has been for principles to which she clings as to the last vital drop that visits the heart. Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She will commend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. America's glory is not domination, but liberty. Her march is the march of the mind. She has a spear and a shield, but the motto upon her shield is freedom, independence, peace. This has been her declaration. This has been, as far as her necessary intercourse with the rest of mankind would permit, her practice." Now, square that with the Pompeo interpretation. Can't be done. All right, now how about George Washington? That's going to be a tough nut to crack, right? Don't we remember from school that he disdained entangling alliances, even if he didn't use that exact phrase? Not so, not so. According to Pompeo, Washington favored having many alliances based on policy, humanity, and interest. And if Washington were president today, well, he would be very much in favor of America's various alliances. So Israel, India, Japan, South Korea, etc. Because that would these sorts of alliances make certain that, quote, each Indo-Pacific nation can protect its sovereignty from coercion. All right, well, is that what Washington believed? Well, see, all I have to do is read the text. That's the beautiful thing about all this. All I have to do is just go read Washington, and then I can assess Pompeo's interpretation. Now, I'm going to read you the significant section of Washington's famous farewell address dealing with foreign policy, almost all of it. Because a lot of the rest of the farewell address, the first chunk of it, really is about the importance of unity in America. Once you've gotten that out of the way, he turns to foreign policy. I'm going to read this. It'll take a little while, but I bet for some folks it'll be the first time you ever heard it. And see if there's any Pompeoism in here. Observe good faith and justice towards all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Religion and morality enjoin this conduct, and can it be that good policy does not equally enjoin it? It will be worthy of a free, enlightened, and at no distant period a great nation, to give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. Who can doubt that in the course of time and things, the fruits of such a plan would richly repay any temporary advantages which might be lost by a steady adherence to it? Can it be that Providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue? The experiment, at least, is recommended by every sentiment which ennobles human nature. Alas, is it rendered impossible by its vices? In the execution of such a plan, nothing is more essential than that permanent, inveterate antipathies against particular nations and passionate attachments for others should be excluded, and that in place of them, just and amicable feelings towards all should be cultivated. The nation which indulges towards another a habitual hatred or a habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest. Antipathy in one nation against another disposes each more readily to offer insult and injury, to lay hold of slight causes of umbrage, and to be haughty and intractable when accidental or trifling occasions of dispute occur. Hence frequent collisions, obstinate, envenomed, and bloody contests. The nation, prompted by ill will and resentment, sometimes impels to war the government, contrary to the best calculations of policy. The government sometimes participates in the national propensity and adopts through passion what reason would reject. At other times, it makes the animosity of the nation subservient to projects of hostility instigated by pride, ambition, and other sinister and pernicious motives. The peace, often, sometimes perhaps the liberty of nations, has been the victim. So likewise, a passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, and infusing into one the enmities of the other, betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without adequate inducement or justification. It leads also to concessions to the favorite nation of privileges denied to others, which is apt doubly to injure the nation making the concessions by unnecessarily parting with what ought to have been retained and by exciting jealousy, ill will, and a disposition to retaliate in the parties from whom equal privileges are withheld. And it gives to ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens who devote themselves to the favorite nation facility to betray or sacrifice the interests of their own country without odium, sometimes even with popularity, gilding with the appearances of a virtuous sense of obligation, a commendable deference for public opinion, or a laudable zeal for public good, the base or foolish compliances of ambition, corruption, or infatuation. Against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, I conjure you to believe me, fellow citizens, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of republican government. But that jealousy, to be useful, must be impartial, else it becomes the instrument of the very influence to be avoided, instead of a defense against it. Excessive partiality for one foreign nation and excessive dislike of another cause those whom they actuate to see danger only on one side and serve to veil and even second the arts of influence on the other. Real patriots who may resist the intrigues of the favorite are liable to become suspected and odious, while its tools and dupes usurp the applause and confidence of the people to surrender their interests. The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible. So far as we have already formed engagements, let them be fulfilled with perfect good faith. Here let us stop. Europe has a set of primary interests which to us have none, or a very remote relation. Hence she must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are essentially foreign to our concerns. Hence, therefore, it must be unwise in us to implicate ourselves by artificial ties in the ordinary vicissitudes of her politics or the ordinary combinations and collisions of her friendships or enmities. Our detached and distant situation invites and enables us to pursue a different course. If we remain one people under an efficient government, the period is not far off when we may defy material injury from external annoyance, when we may take such an attitude as will cause the neutrality we may at any time resolve upon to be scrupulously respected, when belligerent nations, under the impossibility of making acquisitions upon us, will not lightly hazard the giving us provocation, when we may choose peace or war, as our interest guided by justice shall counsel. Why forgo the advantages of so peculiar a situation? Why quit our own to stand upon foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, or caprice? All right, I think Washington's views are pretty self-explanatory there. But what Smith argues in the article is that the influence of Leo Strauss may have something to teach us here, or may help shed light on this situation. Leo Strauss, as you may know, was an important 20th century political philosopher who wrote an awful lot about the history of political philosophy. And there are a good number of Straussians, like Paul Wolfowitz. A lot of the people around George W. Bush subscribed to the ideas of Leo Strauss. And there are a lot to be said about Strauss. But the particular thing that Smith is driving at in this article about Pompeo is the idea that Strauss had about esotericism and exotericism in reading philosophical texts. And what Strauss claimed is that in a lot of cases throughout history, the philosophers have tended to be at odds with the majority of their fellow citizens. For example, a lot of the philosophers may not have believed in the gods their fellow citizens believed in. So how were they going to convey their ideas? Were they just going to come right out and speak ill of or even ridicule ideas and entities believed in by the public? Or were they to be more circumspect in how they spoke, or even appropriate the ideas, language, and concepts of their fellow citizens in the service of their own philosophy? And so what Strauss will say is that, in effect, there we can find, in many cases, an esoteric meaning. So the exoteric meaning would be the surface meaning of what's being said, but we can see beneath there, oftentimes, that philosophers are trying to tell us something else to the listening public that can go beyond superficialities, and the listening public that may be skeptical of the orthodoxies of their day may be able to find the true hidden meaning of the text. And what some critics of Strauss, and the Straussians in particular, have argued is that the Straussians, people like Wolfowitz and Pompeo, are of the belief that the masses are too stupid to know what's good for them, and they're also too stupid to be ruled by the wise philosophers who ought to rule them. So the wise philosophers will more or less rule through statesmen who will use the ideas that are current in their day but twist them in ways as to give them a new meaning. And so that's what Pompeo is doing with George Washington. It's what he's doing with John Quincy Adams. And so there's a famous passage from Strauss that seems to recommend this as a strategy to be employed. Here's that passage. "Philosophy or science, the highest activity of man, is the attempt to replace opinion about all things by knowledge of all things. But opinion is the element of society. Philosophy or science is the attempt to dissolve the element in which society breathes and thus endangers society. Hence, philosophy or science must remain the preserve of a small minority, and philosophers or scientists must respect the opinions on which society rests. To respect is something entirely different from accepting them as true. Philosophers or scientists who hold this view about the relationship of philosophy or science and society are driven to employ a peculiar manner of writing, which would enable to reveal what they regard as the truth to the few, without endangering the unqualified commitment of the many to the opinions on which society rests. They will distinguish between the true teachings as the esoteric teaching and the socially useful teaching as the exoteric teaching. Whereas the exoteric teaching is meant to be easily accessible to every reader, the esoteric teaching discloses itself only to the very careful and well-trained readers after long and concentrated study. And so the argument here would be somebody like Pompeo figures, I want my wars and I'll get them by using whatever stupid language I have to use and appropriating whatever concepts I have to appropriate. Whatever I need to, if I have to deceive these stupid rubes to get my way, then that's what I'm going to do. That's how a lot of people have interpreted that particular passage. Now, again, it's not to say that in history there haven't been cases of philosophers who did have an esoteric meaning precisely for the reasons that Leo Strauss describes. But I was just reading the other day what something that Paul Gottfried had said about Strauss. And he says, okay, Strauss, he says, is not the only person who has proposed this idea. But here's Gottfried. What distinguishes the Straussian approach are two characteristics. The far-fetched, numerologically arcane character of the reading, we haven't gotten into that, and the tendency of the Straussian interpreter to discover his own contemporary views reflected in the thinker whose secret thoughts are supposedly being uncovered. Now, before I carry on to the second piece that I want to talk to you about, and there is a link, I think, between them, I want to remind you that aboard this year's Contra Cruise, happening about a month from now, starting July 5th, 2019, your friend and mine, Bob Murphy, will be debating me on pacifism, Bob in favor and with me against. And the loser is not only disgraced for all time, but the loser has to shave his beard while on board the ship. And how are we going to shave that beard? With a Harry's razor I'm going to be bringing and holding up in front of the audience, because of course Harry's razors are the official razors of the Tom Wood Show. Now, why is that? Because they give you a smooth, close, comfortable shave. They're inexpensive because they're not full of crazy features you're never going to need or want. What matters is Harry's bought a world-class blade factory in Germany that's been making some of the best razor blades in the world for 99 years. That's what you want in your razor, is a really good, strong, sharp blade. That's why I love Harry's. I'm a beard guy now, but still got to trim that neck, and the neck is the most sensitive area of all. I'm not letting just anything near there. It's got to be a Harry's razor. Well, you can get a trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle for an easy grip, five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade for a close shave, rich lathering shave gel that'll leave you smelling great, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy on the go. Listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/woods. Make sure you go to harrys.com/woods to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. All right, second piece will be quicker. Andrew Bacevich, I've talked to him in a previous episode. He is, I think, one of the great foreign policy commentators. He's got a piece called How the War Party Broke Trump. And I personally think that's because he invited these people in. That's my thing. If he's upset about John Bolton, who the heck brought John Bolton in? How can you be upset at anybody else other than yourself? Why would you bring in John Bolton? Really? Why would you bring in Pompeo if you believe the things you say you believe? So when you have a president like this, in some ways, Trump is more like George W. Bush than he wants to admit. George W. Bush was a not particularly bright, amiable dolt who was surrounded by people who knew they could manipulate this idiot. Well, likewise with Trump. I think Trump is smarter than George W. Bush, but I think with politics, his knowledge is a mile wide and an inch deep. And so it's very easy to do what Pompeo is doing, which is to try to take Trumpian rhetoric and concepts, but just use them to push a neoconservative agenda, use them to push intervention, to give the impression that you're somehow in continuity with Trump, even though you're advocating intervention. And given that Trump is not particularly deep in his knowledge and his curiosity, you might just be able to get away with that. And so that's what we saw with the piece on Pompeo, and that's what I think the link is with this piece about Trump. So Bacevich says, only rarely have I agreed with Trump on anything. His frequent and apparently sincere denunciations of our various wars in the greater Middle East stand as the principal exception to that statement. As both candidate and president, Trump has repeatedly made clear his intention to extricate the United States from the vast military quagmire that his several predecessors, both Republicans and Democrats, have created in that region. Consistency has not been a strong suit of Trump's administration. Yet terminating our interminable wars while lowering the U.S. military profile in the Islamic world does seem to be something to which the president is actually committed. Yet the national security apparatus and members of his own administration have opposed him every step of the way. Trump wanted U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. They're still there. He wanted U.S. troops out of Syria. They're still there. So too are 5,000 more in neighboring Iraq, more than 16 years after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And then we get to this. Now, he doesn't talk about Straussianism here, but listen to this. The nominal rationale for the U.S. military presence and combat actions in the greater Middle East changes with dizzying frequency. It once had something to do with overthrowing dictators, spreading democracy, and promoting human rights. Then, for a time, the mission was to eliminate terrorism. Somewhere along the line, it changed to promoting stability. Now the focus has shifted to Iran, assigned a place in the pecking order of official U.S. adversaries that once belonged to Saddam, then to al-Qaeda, and then to ISIS. We don't have a strategy in the greater Middle East. We merely have a variable roster of enemies. Well, we don't need to appeal to that Straussian principle that I mentioned before to account for the dizzying array of rationales. But it certainly fits, doesn't it? We'll use whatever rationale we need to get the stupid rubes to acquiesce in what we're doing. The stupid rubes don't really have to go along with what we're doing. It's enough that they just acquiesce in it. And so we'll just say what we need to say. And Basevich says that the significance now of the war drums being beaten against Iran is that the wars are just going to keep on going. He says, recall the tenor of the discussion in recent days about the possible direction of U.S. policy. First, there was the leaked Pentagon report of a war plan, 100,000 troops earmarked for commitment. Then there was the leaked, quote, defensive deployment of 10,000 troops to protect U.S. forces already there. He said, it's not the numbers that matter, but the assumption that the problems facing the U.S. in the Middle East are military problems, and they're just going to require further and further military action on top of all the current interventions. And so we have the New York Times revealing, quote, President Trump has decided to deploy about 1,500 additional American troops to the Middle East to provide protection for American service members already there. And Basevich says the numbers are beside the point. Basically, Trump has drawn his line in the sand, one that says, we ain't leaving, no sir. And Basevich says, his decision, was it really his, is in effect a capitulation. Trump has deferred to the institutions, interests, and individuals intent on perpetuating the forever wars. Devious and diabolical and brilliant, the war party, abetted by its foreign auxiliaries, has prevailed. Trump will now surely bequeath those wars to his successor. That's the significance of the Iran war scare. And then, this is the great conclusion, Trump is the closest thing we've had to an anti-war president since Jimmy Carter, and perhaps since Herbert Hoover. But today, no president, even one who recognizes the folly of our foreign policy misadventures, is a match for the war machine. Democrats looking for evidence of conspiracy and collusion ought to turn their attention there. Brings me no pleasure to report that, but report it I must. I'll link to these pieces at tomwoods.com/1419. But before we part ways for today, I have a nice little announcement. I've told you that the New York City premiere of our documentary, The Housing Bubble, is running on June 26th. That's this very month of this very year, 2019. And that following the screening, we will have an all-star financial panel consisting of Peter Schiff, Gene Epstein, David Tice, and Jim Grant. And I'm now very pleased to announce that moderating that panel will be Liz Claman, formerly of CNBC, now on Fox Business as host of Countdown to the Closing Bell. So it's going to be an absolutely tremendous event. I cannot urge you enough to attend. You can get tickets over at tomwoods.com/NYC. Bring your friends, tell people about it. It'll be what a great evening out. One of the advantages, might as well enjoy, given all the disadvantages you have living in the New York City area, might as well enjoy it when there's an evening like this available. So, of course, I'll be there too, and I'd love to meet some of you folks, and we'll have a nice time. So check that out, tomwoods.com/NYC. And if you enjoy and appreciate these episodes I keep churning out, then I would be delighted to welcome you into what I like to call the Tom Woods Show Elite, which you can join over at supportinglisteners.com. You get many benefits. I just added a whole new membership level for the super-duper deluxe elite. that you will enjoy very much. Also, check that out for me at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.